Certainly, the steps that the U.S., Europe, and others are taking are a giant signal to Chinese officials and automakers about the challenges that they face on the global stage, primarily in terms of market access, but also in terms of access to technology and partners. And they're necessarily adjusting their plans as a result of this.
The AIG Global Trade Series 2024 is a series of podcasts brought to you by AIG in partnership with some of the world's leading centers of expertise on global trade. Visit www.aig.com/GTS. The series moderator is Rem Korteweg of the Klingendahl Institute.
Hello and welcome to this episode of the AIG Global Trade Series 2024. This is your host, Rem Korteweg from the Klingendahl Institute in the Netherlands. And today's topic is electric vehicles, China and the US. Now, on May 14th, President Joe Biden announced a set of tariff measures designed, as he put it, to counter China's unfair trade practices in a number of strategic sectors. This comes amid growing concerns that in order to boost domestic economic growth, the Chinese economy is disrupting global markets with industrial overcapacity. Now, among the measures President Biden announced was a hike in the tariff rate on Chinese electric vehicles from 25% to 100%. Now, cars have always been a sensitive issue from the perspective of trade policy. Think, for instance, about U.S. concerns over Japanese car imports in the 1980s, and electric vehicles today are no exception. Now, China has signaled that it is considering retaliatory measures on U.S. car sales in China, but at the moment of this conversation, we don't know yet what those retaliatory measures are. The question I'd like to talk about is how to make sense of the current dispute over cars and whether it is a harbinger for further trade tensions between the U.S. and China. How does this fit into the broader trade dynamic between Washington and Beijing? And what does this hold for the future? To help make sense of this, I'm joined by two fantastic trade experts and China watchers from Washington, D.C. Firstly, I'm joined by Scott Kennedy. Scott is senior advisor and trustee chair in Chinese business and economics at CSIS, the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He is a leading authority on Chinese economic policy and U.S.-China commercial relations. His specific areas of expertise include industrial policy, technology innovation, and U.S.-China commercial relations. Secondly, I'm joined by Wendy Cutler. Wendy is vice president at the Asia Society Policy Institute, ASPI, and the managing director of its Washington, D.C. office. Now, Wendy works on trade, investment, and innovation, as well as women's empowerment in Asia. But very interestingly, before joining ASPI, she was a diplomat and negotiator in the office of the U.S. Trade Representative, where she also served as acting deputy USTR. At the USTR, she worked on a range of bilateral, regional, multilateral trade negotiations, including U.S.-Korea Free Trade Agreement, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and U.S.-China bilateral trade issues. A very warm welcome to you both. Now, let's dive right in. Scott, can you start us off by telling us what, in your view, the background is to the current dispute about electric vehicles? In other words, how did we get into a situation where the U.S. administration is quadrupling tariffs on Chinese EVs?
Well, it's good to be here with you and Wendy. I can start at the broadest and get to the most specific. So the U.S. and China have very different types of economic systems, and they have very, very different visions of the global economic order, particularly with regard to the role of the state in the economy. And they have very different national security interests. And so we've seen over the last 7 to 8 years, relations deteriorate as the Biden administration describes it. We are in a strategic competition with China. And on the economic front, that means we're worried about Chinese industrial policy, supply chain resilience, dual-use technologies. In this case, what we are seeing is Chinese industrial policy turbo-boosted to support a variety of critical sectors that China feels is important for its growth long-term, to partly replace the support that they have had in real estate, but also knowing that they don't have reliable suppliers of technology and markets in the West any longer. And so they have put a big bet on electric vehicles. It also helps them address what has been a long time air pollution problem and climate, and to try and capture these technologies of the future. And so China has put massive amounts of state support and subsidies into this industry. And they are a very, very large economy. Their auto market 6x the US market. And so what's happened is they have given big green lights to companies to jump in. And they have. Traditional Chinese automakers, new companies, and others have poured into this market. There are over 150 Chinese EV producers. And that's a lot of supply at a point when demand in China is weak because of the post-COVID problems their economy has faced. And even if demand was up, it still wouldn't absorb all of this supply. And so China has started to export vehicles at a very high clip, challenging the auto sectors in Europe, Asia, and the United States, and therefore a need for these other auto producers to respond. And then we've got 2024, even number years or election years in the United States, and the Biden administration needs to show that it is tough on China, hence the timing of this action. But I think it's not just simply politics, it's also about international trade and about U.S.-China relations.
Right. And thanks for that. And Wendy, I mean, Scott mentioned that the Chinese market isn't going to be able to absorb the amount of production that's coming out of Chinese EV factories. I mean, we see this, I think, very much in a European context, but in a US context, there aren't all that many Chinese brand EVs yet on the US market. So can you walk us through the steps that the U.S. has taken and also how this relates to this question, whether it's more preemptive than it is perhaps corrective, this set of tariff measures?
In my view, this is a preemptive move by the United States. And in some ways, this is a new development because typically the U.S. has waited until injury has taken place. Then we've acted. It's been too late. And our industries have suffered, and some, like the solar industry, have never really been able to rebound. So based on the lessons of the past, when the U.S. acted too late, the Biden administration decided, let's take action now. While there's very little trade, very few Chinese electric vehicle exports coming into the United States, and send a strong signal to China that your cars are not welcome in the United States.
And what do you think is the Chinese response to that going to be?
Well, we've already seen China vocally opposing this measure. They've called the United States protectionist. They've called us hypocritical. They've called us violators of WTO rules. So that's always number one. And the question is, what concrete measures may follow? We don't know the answer, but in my view, based on past experience, I think we'll see a proportional, measured response from China. I don't think they're seeking to escalate tension with the United States right now. The package of tariffs that include electric vehicles that was announced last week is valued at $18 billion of Chinese exports to the U.S. So I could see China putting together its own package of products with tariff hikes to impose on U.S. imports into China. Now, of course, they could also choose to restrict certain critical minerals. They could take measures against U.S. auto companies in China. They have a range of tools, but I would put my bets on, again, a proportional response based on tariff increases against U.S. imports.
Scott, do you agree? I saw you nodding to some of Wendy's points. What kind of retaliation should we keep in mind?
It would be funner if I disagreed with Wendy, but I think we're on the same page here. You know, the $18 billion in targeted imports is about 4.2% of U.S. imports from China. The equivalent in the other direction would be about $6 billion of U.S. exports. And there's been some media speculation from Chinese state media and others that China would target certain segments of foreign cars from the US and perhaps Europe, you know, large engine cars that they might target. And they've just started an anti-dumping investigation as well into chemicals, primarily American and European chemicals. And that stuff, lo and behold, adds up to roughly around $6 billion in exports to China. And they've talked about a few other things. I think not only is precedent matter, I think it's also important that in this era in which the U.S. is trying to take targeted actions to de-risk and protect itself, as others are doing as well, the Chinese still see the possibility of a very broad and deep economic relationship. They are dependent on the West for markets, for certain kinds of technology. The level of connectivity is actually quite high. And so they're unlikely to want to actually escalate and break the relationship unless the U.S. and others declare economic war on China, which is certainly possible given the choices the U.S. voters will face later this year. But under current circumstances, I think they're looking to not have this blow up into something much, much larger.
That's really interesting because that in some ways suggests that we're not going to see this snowball into other sectors. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
I don't see this snowballing, but the U.S. and others are thinking about potential restrictions in other areas. And so this is less a snowball, one big, then multiple actions going on at the same time. There probably at some point will be restrictions related to biopharma, other kinds of data, AI, et cetera. As part of that small yard, high fence strategy, we're seeing more yards be created, some eminent domain-like actions occurring by the administration and Chinese retaliation. So sort of incremental adjustments, but no grand blow up, at least right now. I don't think that's what either side wants. Of course, when you get tit for tat, you never know where you may end up.
I would just add that in terms of Chinese counter-retaliation against just our tariff announcement, there is no reason to believe that they would limit that package just to autos, that they may and are likely to include products in other sectors that would hurt the U.S. and kind of, you know, encourage us to rethink our decision. So it could involve other sectors, but again, I think it won't be escalatory and it won't lead us then to feel like we have to counter respond like happened during the Trump trade wars.
And how will this impact, say, other trade partners? So Korea, Japan, the European Union, which are also equally concerned about Chinese overcapacity. There's also an element of national security concerns, perhaps less pronounced than in the U.S. debate. But how do you think this dynamic between the U.S. and China and these new tariff measures are going to play out in relationship to, again, trading partners like Korea, Japan, and others?
Well, in general, our other trading partners don't like it when we increase our tariffs against China. Number one, they feel that we're flaunting the WTO rules, and a lot of these other countries really depend on the WTO system to allow them to conduct the type of trading relationships that they're interested in. But one immediate impact, I think, will be that as the U.S. has made it clear that these Chinese electric vehicles are not welcome in the United States, and as Scott mentioned earlier, there's all this overcapacity. These products need to go somewhere. And so it may end up in a situation where these cars then are exported in larger volumes to other countries. And that could lead certain countries to be concerned and, you know, maybe take countermeasures. It'll be interesting to see how Europe comes out with respect to the anti-subsidies investigation that's underway. But we understand by the time this podcast may be broadcasted that we'll know the tariff rate that the EU is looking at. But I am sure in Brussels now, they are carefully looking at 100%, at the 100% tariff we imposed and trying to figure out if that's going to create more problems for them and invite more Chinese cars to Europe. And if so, do they need to take stricter and more robust measures against Chinese overcapacity in this sector?
And do you think that then would push the EU to also consider higher tariffs of its own to protect its market, because you have that waterbed effect that you're describing with Chinese trade then ending up in Europe rather than in the US?
Well, it's interesting because I think the EU is going to be more constrained by WTO rules than the United States, and they've made that clear. And they'll want to show the world that their anti-subsidies investigation was conducted in accordance with WTO rules, and they will want to win any case, dispute settlement case, that China, for example, may take against them. So I'm not sure how they may respond or how our tariff rate may affect their proceedings. But again, I think this is a fluid area. And as Scott mentioned before, we need to keep in mind that as Chinese electric vehicle companies are investing more and more in third countries, this tariff action we just took does not impact those exports from third countries. So I am confident we are going to see other measures against electric vehicle imports from Chinese car companies, even if they're from third country markets. And I think the EU, after this anti-subsidies investigation, will also be looking at how they're going to cope and deal with this surge of Chinese imports. Just one concluding note, Europe has made it clear that Chinese investment in electric vehicles is welcome in Europe. And that may be their way, the Brussels way, to kind of deal with this. In the US, I don't see that happening. That is the way we kind of got out of our trade tensions in this sector with Korea and Japan. But I do not see the US welcoming Chinese FDI in the electric vehicle sector in the United States.
You mentioned that's how we got out of our tensions with Korea and Japan. I mean, in my introduction, I also mentioned that it seems on the face of it that there are some parallels between now and earlier periods where the US has had strong concerns about automobile imports. Scott, can you reflect on that and perhaps, you know, point out why things may be similar or where they are different today than a couple of decades ago?
Sure. Well, yes, the U.S. has tried to protect its auto sector and support it for a long time against unfair competition, and we've been very active in that regard. We've also tried to run faster by innovating and investing around the world. So we do have an extremely innovative auto industry and supply chain that is as much based in Silicon Valley now as it is in Detroit and other parts of the country. In the past, particularly in the 1980s, when we came across this issue vis-a-vis Japan, and Wendy can speak to this as well, I mean, I think there are a variety of different options. And in my own conversations with Chinese officials over the last few months, I've heard similar responses as in before. So some Chinese told me, you know what, there actually is no problem. We are exporting based on comparative advantage, and we are helping address the world's decarbonization problem. So just send us a thank you card. Don't do anything. I've also heard, if you have a problem, go to the WTO, right? And given how long it takes to adjudicate a WTO case, no one is moving in that direction. The option that comes up most often beside, you know, where we've landed now on tariffs is some type of managed trade solution where there's mutual agreement from all sides about constraining exports either through a fixed number or some type of quota or some type of percentage, either done by governments or basically a cartel, something like that. And that kind of thing was discussed more in the 1980s and early 1990s. I don't think that's actually how we ended up solving the problems, as Wendy can attest to. And you bring that up with the Chinese, and they don't want any part of that kind of solution because they don't want to legitimate constraints on their exports and have the problem perceived only as a China side problem, because in their mind, there's insufficient global demand. That's the problem. And so I think we're at loggerheads, which is why the administration acted and why we're seeing measures adopted in other places.
And so, and Wendy, I'll come to you in a second to respond to this. But in your view, Scott, where does that then lead us? So if option one and two aren't acceptable for the US and option three isn't acceptable for China,
Well, I think a combination of things. I think protecting your market in a global economy is a little bit like musical chairs. You know, you don't want to be the last one to sit down and impose protection, because then you'll be hit with greater imports and injury. And so I do think we're going to see necessarily greater tariffs against Chinese vehicles. I do think, though, that there will be a difference between the U.S. and Europe, as Wendy has already alluded to. Chinese investment in Europe is already pretty significant amongst automakers and battery makers, and I think we'll see that grow. There are no legal obstacles at all to Chinese investment in the United States. However, there's significant political anxieties, which might slow them down, and potential other regulations related to data security that could then actually really impact the availability of Chinese cars. And so Chinese automakers that I talk to, battery makers, are voluntarily deciding not to invest in the United States because they see the dangers that could come from plunking down billions of dollars and then actually having the market cut off to them. So I think we're going to see maybe similarities in tariffs, but other alternative kinds of strategies. I think the big question is, in terms of support, what will the U.S. and others do with this protective umbrella? Will they accelerate the electrification of auto fleets, install more charging stations and infrastructure, and use this as an opportunity to move in that direction? Or will companies benefit from the protection and slow down or not really change their behavior in response to this challenge?
Yeah, great. Wendy?
Yeah, so as someone who negotiated with Japan and Korea for many years with respect to the automotive sector, one key difference with China is, at the end of the day, Japan and Korea were our allies. So even though trade tensions got really high during some of these negotiations, and particularly during the 80s and 90s, we did find a way to kind of cool things down and come up with an accommodation, which, again, was a combination of measures, but definitely included inviting foreign direct investment from companies from those countries. With respect to like where we're going, I couldn't agree more with Scott that this is the moment where U.S. auto companies need to step up to the plate and do everything possible to accelerate their competitiveness, because the competition from Chinese companies is large. You know, companies like BYD and other Chinese companies are building very competitively priced cars, but also high quality cars. And so this is the moment for our car companies to step up to the plate. And as Scott mentioned, for the U.S. to kind of put our resources behind building a competitive U.S. auto industry.
And is this something you can do bilaterally? I mean, is this something that you do in a bilateral context between the U.S. and China, or do just bringing in the other partners that we just mentioned, is this something that you do in a G7 context, or is there a similar amount of competition between, say, the U.S., the Japanese, and the Europeans?
Well, first, with respect to any response we have, given how integrated our auto market is with Mexico and Canada, we need to really coordinate with those countries. And there have already been reports that the U.S., in conversations with Mexico in particular, is trying to discourage them from inviting and giving incentives to Chinese auto production in Mexico. But more broadly, I do think we need to coordinate with our allies and partners and come up with a more unified response to industrial overcapacity in China and China kind of exporting its way out of the situation. And it doesn't mean we all need to follow the same policies. I don't think that's going to happen. But I do think we need to coordinate and send a unified message to China that this type of predatory behavior is unacceptable and that countries will respond. And already, it's not just the U.S. and the EU that is looking at taking measures. Brazil, for example, is increasing its auto tariffs against China over the next couple of years. We've seen Mexico take some measures, South Africa and others. So I think this is not just a bilateral problem. I think the prospects of like one global response to China are pretty slim. I'm closely watching the G7 summit meeting that will be held next month. And I suspect that there will be pretty tough language with respect to concerns about Chinese overcapacity and the trade distorting global economic impacts it is having, and the need for China to take measures to restrain exports.
And Scott, you talk to Chinese officials regularly, Chinese automakers. You've been to China recently. Do you think that development of G7 language or even multilateral coordination among a number of other important markets for Chinese cars, that message resonates inside China?
Certainly, the steps the U.S., Europe, and others are taking are a giant signal to Chinese officials and automakers about the challenges that they face on the global stage, primarily in terms of market access, but also in terms of access to technology and partners. And they're necessarily adjusting their plans as a result of this. You know, this is a challenging situation because not only is there significant Chinese industrial policy, which is obviously, at least from my perspective, unfair, but you also individually have a lot of impressive Chinese car companies and battery companies. Having visited several of them, these are not tin cars that are just going to fall apart on you. They are quite impressive. I went to Xiaomi, I've visited NIO, XPeng, Geely, BYD. They have benefited some Chinese car makers from long-term partnerships, but also upstarts, like some of the companies that I mentioned that used to be in infotech and have moved. And with the shift from internal combustion engines to electric motors, they've been able to be quite competitive. So the challenge is we want to send an incentive for China to have good companies. But if everyone jumps in the market and there's overcapacity, given China's scale, there's negative consequences for the rest of the world potentially. And so that requires Chinese officials to be much more cognizant of the global consequences of what they do. And unfortunately, this means that some Chinese companies are going to face more significant obstacles. In the case of Europe, BYD and some others have provided data to the EU authorities, to the European Commission, and hope to get lower tariffs placed on them relative to the general tariff that will be placed on Chinese as a whole. And that may lead to some variation. But for the most part, it means good and bad are all going to get hammered at the same time.
In a European context, there's a lot of criticism about the U.S. tariffs because it impacts, like one of you said, that there's the decarbonization dimension, which, of course, in a European context resonates in a different way. How is that discussion in the U.S. seen, that balance between, on the one hand, pursuing industrial policy, on the other hand, protecting the U.S. automobile sector, as well as the challenge of moving forward with greening the car fleet?
Yeah, I think there's a strong debate about this. So some voices say that the U.S., by imposing tariffs, is inevitably delaying its green transition because it has access to extremely affordable Chinese cars right now and batteries that would make these more affordable for middle-class Americans who can't spend $70,000, $80,000 on a Tesla, but could on a car that was much cheaper. The alternative argument is that the American auto companies and others are also electrifying their fleets. The U.S. also wants to be a leader in green technologies, but they can't do so if their auto industry and the supply chain is destroyed by Chinese competition. So this is meant to buy the U.S. and the rest of the world some time so that they can accelerate their own capabilities and become much more price competitive. Those are the alternative arguments. So no one is, I mean, I suppose there are some voices in the United States who say, you know, climate change and all of that is a hoax and everyone ought to, you know, buy gas guzzlers. But I think that's not the most central part of the debate about whether or not tariffs should be imposed against China in this sector or in other industries.
And I would just keep in mind that with the funds from the Inflation Reduction Act now being distributed all around the United States, that the U.S. is now, you know, making a concerted push towards the green energy transition. And when I look at this question, the way I answer this, we need to look at short-term versus longer-term. And at the end of the day, you know, does the United States or the rest of the world want to be dependent on China for clean technology products and not have their own domestic companies? And when you keep in mind that many of these Chinese companies, they didn't just come in this market on their own. They got incredible support and subsidies that allow them to offer cheaper prices, allow them not to be driven by profits, allow them not to respond to market signals if overcapacity or their inventories are increasing. And so are we just going to stand by and say that's okay? Or are we going to kind of marshal our domestic resources to make sure that we have our own vibrant industry and technologies here?
Thanks for that. I have one final question for both of you, which is, as you mentioned, Scott, it's 2024, it's an election year. What do you expect from both looking at the language of both candidates for the near term of the U.S.-China trade relationship? I mean, perhaps also highlighting the role that China is or isn't playing in the campaign so far. But what would you expect from another Biden administration on trade with China and with President Trump?
Well, making predictions is difficult, particularly about the future. I think someone mentioned that once. So
Yogi Berra, right?
That's right. So I will say that if the Biden administration keeps in the direction it's going, we're going to continue to see incremental measures imposed related to protecting American competitiveness, making supply chains more resilient and reducing overdependency on China, dealing with restricting technologies that could help China's military. We're going to continue to see incremental efforts in those areas. And I think the Biden administration has tried to be highly empirical and fact-based about this and not just run amok and cover everything at once. But I do think we'll see incremental steps in that direction. We'll see Chinese moves back, continued efforts to strengthen their own capabilities in these industries. There's a possibility post-election that with not facing a third term down the road in 2028, if the U.S. economy is doing well, perhaps the Biden administration would be more open to a more ambitious trade agenda and perhaps look to liberalize and reduce restrictions around the world, perhaps not vis-a-vis China, but with others. But that's a sort of a hopeful sign rather than something that I'm sure about. I think with the Trump administration, if that's what American voters choose, then I think a lot of this nuance goes out the window and we're in a much greater trade brawl with China and perhaps other countries as well. And it looks much more like Fortress America on the trade front.
Wendy?
With respect to like tariff policy, I think there is a big distinction between the Biden camp and the Trump camp. I mean, again, the package of tariffs that were announced by the Biden administration are very targeted on specific products that were the result of like years of interagency investigations, assessments, and decisions. And so this package just wasn't put together overnight. When it comes to the Trump to Trump and what he's saying about tariffs, he's talking about like 60% across the board for all Chinese imports. That's a very different policy, and that's very escalatory, because if China had to respond to that, then we're gonna end up in another world of tit for tat. And so that does concern me. The other thing I would just emphasize is I think the Biden administration realizes, yeah, tariffs are important, but they're not the only tool. And so they have been very adept at looking at other tools, including this investigation. They're currently undertaking the data connectivity of electric vehicles. And so we'll have to see if there is a Trump administration, if they will also be more nuanced or look at other tools. But the signals we're getting from the candidates suggest otherwise.
Thanks so much. And we'll be sure to bring both of you back to the podcast after the elections to help make sense of where U.S.-China policy is going. But unfortunately, this is all we have time for today. Again, thank you very much to you, Wendy Cutler, and you, Scott Kennedy, for talking to me today. This has been terrific. And please check out our other conversations for the AIG Global Trade Series at www.aig.com/GTS. or get them through your podcast app.
The AIG Global Trade Series 2024 is an international partnership between AIG, the Aspen Institute, Germany, CEPRI, the Brazilian Center for International Relations, Chatham House, CITD, the Center on Inclusive Trade and Development at Georgetown University Law Center, the Klingendahl Institute, Elcano Royal Institute, AREA, the Economic Research Institute for ASEAN and East Asia, ISPI, the Italian Institute for International Political Studies, the Jacques Delors Institute, Rieti, the Research Institute of Economy, Trade and Industry, and the St. Gallen Endowment for Prosperity Through Trade. To access articles and opinion pieces from partners in the Global Trade Series, and to listen to more episodes on global trade, visit www.aig.com/GTS or follow the AIG Global Trade Series wherever you get your podcasts. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast series are those of the speakers and do not reflect the views, policy, or position of American International Group, Inc., or its subsidiaries or affiliates, AIG. Any content provided by the speakers in this podcast series is their opinion and is not intended to malign any religion, ethnic group, club, organization, company, individual, or group of individuals, or anyone or anything. AIG makes no warranty or representations as to the accuracy, completeness, correctness, or validity of any information provided during this podcast series, and AIG will not be liable for any errors, inaccuracies, or omissions in the information provided during this podcast series, or any damages, losses, liabilities, injuries resulting from or arising from the podcast, including your use of the podcast.